And we now continue, my friends, with the 13th chapter of the book of the Revelation, which pertains to the description of the Antichrist. And the Holy Evangelist is now continuing this description. He saw a beast ascending or rising up out of the sea. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. This is truly an awesome description based on what the Holy Evangelist John is telling us. The beast which the Holy Evangelist sees is a cross-section of the four beasts, those rising up from the great sea, the Mediterranean Sea, that is, which Daniel the prophet saw in a vision. And he describes it for us in his 7th chapter. According to Daniel's vision, the first beast was a lioness, which represented the Babylonian Empire. The second beast was a bear, and it represented the Medo-Persian Empire, or dynasty. The third beast was a leopard, and it symbolized the Greek Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great. The fourth beast is not given a name because it is very strange, very hard to describe, and very monstrous. And it represents the Roman Empire. The fourth beast, as Daniel sees it and describes it in the 7th chapter of his book, had 10 horns. At some point, Daniel sees in amazement a smaller, dreadful, and very powerful horn, a little one coming up among the 10 horns, and by its very presence 3 of the 10 horns were plucked up by the roots. And Daniel points out, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So this little horn had eyes like those of a man, and it had a mouth that boasted of great things. And as an angel interprets this vision to Daniel, this little horn happens to be a king, as he now points out in the text. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute and wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then authority shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. In simpler terms, this king, according to the interpretation of the angel, this small and strange horn which suddenly came up, this king will speak, will let out of his mouth very insulting and offensive words against God. And he will make old the saints of God, according to the Greek text, meaning he will exhaust them, he will tire them out, he will annihilate them, and he will persecute and disperse them. And this king will consider an attempt to change nature and times, nature and the laws of God. So he will attempt to alter not only the ethical laws revealed by God, but the natural laws as well. A natural law, for example, is for the mother not to kill her child. This is a natural law. Please listen carefully. This is a natural biological law. This feeling is innate in the animals. Did you ever see a mother cat or a dog to attack and kill her own kittens or puppies? These animals are extremely protective of their children. This is natural. But this strange king will undermine even this natural law, to alter the natural law and the law stemming from God's revelation. A perfect example, my friends, in our days is the plight of homosexuality. In this case, we don't need to have God's revealed truth to tell us how sinister this is. The natural law is very overt on this matter. The same holds true in the area of adultery. Truly, my friends, nature plainly shows us. There are plenty of animals with one spouse, the swallows, the stork, the dove, and so many others. And he shall be given authority to do these things for 3.5 years. We see very clearly here that the description of Daniel the prophet coincides with the description offered here by St. John the Holy Evangelist, and it has to do with the Antichrist. It is also very obvious that Daniel is also speaking about this very Antichrist. Daniel places the Antichrist during the fourth dynasty, the Roman, and rightly so, because the Roman emperors did much to antagonize and persecute Christians, and consequently, the Roman Empire was an anti-Christian dynasty. The Roman Empire acts as a God-opposing power. However, Daniel's description does not become exhausted with the Roman Empire, but it extends to the final, the eschatological Antichrist, whose typology is the Roman Empire with its Caesar worship. I repeat, with Caesar worship. I will explain to you a bit later what is the nature of the Caesar worship and exactly how it will serve as the typology of the worship of the Antichrist. However, we must mention before we continue that the mystery of lawlessness, which is the coming of the Antichrist, is already at work even in the Old Testament. We see it in the book of Daniel. And this because the uncreated energy of the precious cross was also active, something that I have told you many times. When the Israelites crossed over the Red Sea, they did so by the uncreated energy of the precious cross, which energy of the Most Holy Cross is without beginning, just like all of God's energies are beginningless, timeless, pre-eternal, and the uncreated energy of the precious cross naturally preceded the historical cross of Golgotha. When Moses struck the sea with his staff to cut it into two, and later he struck again to unite it, with these two motions or movements, he made the sign of the cross. In the desert with the snakes, when he raised a snake to be seen by the ailing Israelites, the bronze snake was tied on a vertical stick. And on the upper part of this stick, there was a shorter horizontal one to keep the snake in place. This was the sign of the cross, and so on. But I would like you to pay attention to these two mysteries so we can get a general sense on how these things work out historically. These two mysteries, the mystery of piety and lawlessness, commence and are at work from the first descendants of Adam. Before I continue, I would like to clearly point out that these two mysteries of piety and lawlessness are already described in the New Testament. The mystery of piety are the faithful, but the mystery of piety is also the church. Listen how St. Paul talks about this in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 9. Having the mystery of faith in pure conscience. Faith is not simply some phenomenon, I happen to believe in God. It is a mystery energized in the world through the uncreated energy of the precious cross of Christ. It would be inconceivable to have people believe in God if the uncreated power of the precious cross was not at work. And this, even in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, and more precisely through the entire length of history. Furthermore, St. Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 3:16, "And without a doubt, the mystery of piety is great." The mystery of piety. And here, some texts use the word godliness. The mystery of piety, or mystery of godliness, the same thing. So what is this mystery of piety? Ευσέβεια in Greek. The mystery of ευσέβεια, or godliness. Listen to this amazing summary. Timothy 3:16. "And without a doubt, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifested in the flesh, justified in the Spirit." God was justified from the Holy Spirit and the works of Jesus Christ, the miracles, etc. "Seen by angels," for the first time in the history of the angels, God became visible in his incarnation. "Preached to the nations," the expansion of Christianity and the church in the entire world. "Was believed on in the world," ascended in glory. So God entered history and exited history. This is the mystery of godliness, or piety. Now, if we needed to summarize this amazing summary of St. Paul even more, make it even more concise, we could simply state that the mystery of godliness is God was manifest in the flesh. In other words, the incarnation of the Son of God, of Jesus Christ. This is the mystery of godliness, also called piety. Exactly what which we believe, what we are. That which we call Christianity. This mystery, as we said, was at work from the time of Adam and Eve. Let's take a close look at precisely how this mystery was at work along the other mystery of lawlessness. Both mysteries were present from the beginning of mankind. Inside paradise, the devil comes to tempt the first created humans. At the same time, God tells Adam and Eve, "You sinned and you must pay the consequences. Death is already introduced. But from you, the woman, one will come who will crush the head of the serpent, while the serpent would only bruise his heel. The injury would be minimal, nothing." This last statement shows what? The mystery of godliness. In essence, the incarnation of the Son of God. He will come from a woman, the most holy Theotokos. Did you see where the cornerstone of the incarnation was established? Inside paradise. Consequently, from that time on, since righteous people always existed on earth, the mystery of godliness is and was already at work, which will be made manifest in a much greater scale with the incarnation of the Son of God 2,000 years ago, and once again with the second presence of Christ, which will be the last and final presence of the Son of God inside history, of the mystery of godliness, of the very fact that God appeared in the flesh. And now from the other side, we have the mystery of lawlessness. At that same time, the devil hears that a descendant of Eve will be the one who will crush his head, and he never forgets. He is watching and searching. I had told you during a previous homily that he was searching the virgins to see who would be the one who would be born. But the virginity of the Theotokos passed by him. He did not notice it. It was hidden from him. However, the holiness of Jesus Christ did not go unnoticed, whose divinity the devil cannot see, of course, being that God is invisible. He only sees the human nature, his body, and his soul, nothing else. And now we have the mystery of lawlessness, which also starts from paradise. Reference to the mystery of lawlessness is also made in the Holy Scriptures once again. St. Paul tells us about this in 2 Thessalonians 2:7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So let's see the journey of this mystery of lawlessness through history. Let's see the order of events of this mystery of lawlessness. The mystery of godliness is preserved by Abel, and the mystery of lawlessness is advanced by Cain. The devil, having seen that Abel, due to his virtue, would become a carrier of the mystery of godliness, instills the idea of the murderer's action in Cain, and Cain kills Abel. With the death of Abel, it seemed that the mystery of godliness was negated, but Seth was born. Now what's interesting, and someone may ask, did Adam and Eve only have 2-3 children? This farther proves our point, being that Adam and Eve had many children, boys and girls, very many children, but Seth is projected as the one to keep the lineage of the Messiah and to serve as Abel's replacement. And here we have the commencement of the two generations, the generation of Seth, which remains very simple, focused on God, and abides under the will of God and the knowledge of God. The opposite holds true for the generation of Cain, since he happens to be the father of a generation full of apostasy from God, a generation refusing the helping hand of God, a generation that moves on to create civilization. Don't forget that civilization is an offspring of the generation of Cain, and finally, the civilized descendants of Cain, of Cain's generation, reached such deplorable, sinful state where God says the generation of Seth must segregate with the generation of Cain, to stay separate, to not even speak to each other, to be totally separate. So here we have the commencement of two generations, two lineages, two lines which must reach all the way to the end of times, to the end of history. But they failed to stay separate. They intermixed. The devil steps in again, ready at any given moment to negate the work of salvation. And he brings forth the mixing of these two generations, and they all sin, all except Noah. And God says, my spirit shall certainly not remain among these men because they are flesh. And he brings on the flood. Noah and his three children were saved, Sam, Shem, and Japheth. From the three children of Noah, the one who carries the straight line from Seth is Sam, the firstborn of Noah. God is constantly segregating the descendants of Sam, and it reaches to Abraham. Abraham is a Semite. God takes Abraham and makes a nation, the Israelites. And this nation, without me going into great details and bringing up other meaningful events, brings forth one person, the Theotokos, the most holy Theotokos, the birth giver of God. And finally, the birth giver of God, the Theotokos, brought the Messiah into the world. Pay a close look at the adventure of this straight line. From the other side, the rest of the world holds on the line of the Antichrist, the entire world. So the church is established upon the earth, and with the presence of Christ, we have the manifestation of the church inside history. A certain action that attempts to negate the work of the Messiah from the time of the Messiah on earth is the action of Judas. Judas works like Cain who manages to kill Abel. The Holy Evangelist is very overt when he writes that the devil entered Judas, so Judas would betray the Lord in order to foil the work of the Lord. Thus, Judas is the spiritual descendant of Cain, and after Judas, we have the great confrontation, the first historical confrontation of Christ and the demons upon the cross. The first great historical confrontation, and the devil lost this battle because Christ appeared righteous upon the cross, and Christ resurrected. And the battle continues. You do remember what we were saying during our last session about the devil, the dragon, who chases the woman, the church, who flees in the desert. The church continues its journey. We are headed for the last days. We are continuing our journey. We are moving towards the end times, and we have two parallel lines of navigation. On the one course, we have Christ, and on the other hand, on the other course, we have the Antichrist. The Antichrist being the servant or the organ of the devil. Then Arius appears. This observation is not mine. It belongs to Father Justin Popovich. And it states that Arius is attempting to foil the work of Christ by teaching and holding that Christ is not God. And this would negate the work of salvation inside the church. He attempts to belittle and humiliate the church, but the church defeats Arius. And we're traveling through the centuries, and the ark of salvation, the church, is floating along. This is a sad thing. We're saddened by what we're about to say, and it's possible some of our listeners may have a negative reaction towards this, but if they would study a little bit of history, they will come to understand. Not to mention that Arius was also a priest. Not only a priest, but a most ascetical one, most ascetical and yet most heretical. And we now come to the Christian West, which West is represented from the various corresponding popes, from the Pope. The Christian West is nothing else other than the secularization of the church, the worldly mindset within the church to such a degree where Father Justin Popovich would have no qualms to state and write that the order is Judas, Arius, Pope, Antichrist. But so you don't get the impression that Father Justin is making this up, I will call upon Saint Cosmas the Aetolian. Saint Cosmas the Aetolian was saying, curse the Pope. But why? Christ told us not to curse anyone. Now why and in what sense does this saint ask us to curse the Pope? Certainly not as a person, not the person of each reigning Pope, but as an office, as a symbol which represents a breathless, secularized church. In this sense, you will curse because the Western thought can be a curse to Orthodoxy. Because Orthodoxy can suffer a terrible and deadly adulteration from the West, nothing less than the very elimination of salvation. This battle is no less than furious between Eastern and Western thought, a furious and relentless battle between Eastern thought and Eastern lifestyle versus Western thought and Western lifestyle. Inexorable, relentless battles all through the centuries. And finally, the Antichrist will come. The devil will bring the Antichrist. And on the other line of navigation, as I told you, Christ will come, and this up to the second coming, where this entire journey will come to an end. So did you see where this struggle begins? This war begins from paradise, from the first created humans, from Adam and Eve, all the way up to the very end. All of these things that we talked about, my friends, already came to pass. Most of these things came to pass. We are at the end. We are near the time of the Antichrist. The only thing left is just that, the coming of the Antichrist. All others have come. Therefore, we have the historical journey of the mystery of godliness and a historical journey of the mystery of lawlessness. They are navigating side by side, and the final confrontation will be a historical one, the reappearing Christ and the Antichrist. St. Paul states this very clearly, that Christ will consume, will destroy the Antichrist. It will be the very final and decisive confrontation, and the victory will be of Christ. This is how Daniel states this in his seventh chapter, which is very important. The seventh chapter of Daniel corresponds to the 13th chapter of Revelation. Up until the Ancient of Days came and he gave the justification, the result of the judgment to the saints of the Most High, and the time came and the kingdom was given over to the saints. Up until he came. Did you see? This is the second coming of Christ. So time ran out, finished, judgment took place, and the kingdom was taken by the saints. It is all over. The Antichrist, the devil, the false prophet were thrown in the Gehenna fire. This is the journey of Christ and the Antichrist within history, before Christ and after Christ. And this to help you always keep a diagram in your mind. And the Holy Evangelist continues, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. The devil gave the Antichrist his own power, his throne, and great authority. Consequently, the invisible spring of the authority and power of the Antichrist, who will always be a man, as I have told you, will be the dragon or Satan. This is what St. Paul writes about in his 2 Thessalonians epistle in chapter 3, verse 9. The men of lawlessness will maneuver according to the energy of Satan. This also becomes apparent from the fact that the dragon appears with 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 crowns. Precisely how the beast, the Antichrist, who appears with 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 crowns. This assimilation of these two dragon beasts proves that the devil will give his authority and his kingdom to the Antichrist. I must repeat, however, one more time, that we don't have the incarnation of Satan. Not at all. All this according to the energy of Satan. The devil will not become a man, as in the case of God who became man, but this will be according to the energy of Satan, meaning the devil will enter a human being. And please observe the malicious craftiness of the devil and how many times he mobilized his powers to nullify the church. The 7 ecumenical councils and the various local councils were the holy effort to neutralize and counter the works of Satan, who was orchestrating the destruction and defilement of the salvific work of the church. And the devil had inspired Nestorius with the following: God did not become man, but he simply entered a man. Listen. He entered inside a man. He suggested that the Theotokos, the birth giver of God, is not that Theotokos, but Christotokos. This heresy was faced successfully by St. Cyril of Alexandria. This heresy teaches that the Most Holy Theotokos did not give birth to God, where the divine nature united with the human nature inside the womb of the birth giver of God. Not so Nestorius maintained, that the Holy Virgin gave birth to a man. She was Christotokos. She was a birth giver of Christ, and subsequently God entered and resided and made his abode inside this man who was born by the Holy Theotokos. This is horrible, truly horrible. The Most Holy Virgin is not Christotokos, but Theotokos. The very thing that the devil himself will do, he tried to inspire to the Christians to embrace this heresy, to torpedo their salvation. Thus, Christ Jesus becomes a real human being, and he remains with his human nature in heaven, and he will maintain the human nature forever and ever unto the ages of ages. The devil does not become man, but he uses his energy inside a man who will be born naturally by his father and mother and will receive the energy of Satan willfully. So this man will be acting according to the energy of Satan. He will be a different person. In the Antichrist and the devil, we have two different persons. In Jesus Christ, though, we don't have two persons. We have one person. We have two natures, the human and the divine, but one person. St. Augustine labels the Antichrist as the ape of Christ, the monkey of Christ. As you know, the ape or the monkey mimics whatever it sees. So the Antichrist will make an attempt to mimic, to copy whatever happened in the life of Christ.